Blog Talk Radio.
For tuning in, some Masonic effects. Another day in the life, and it's a pleasure to have you pulling up your stool and joining us today. And time for a periodic shout out, just because I like doing it, because it is a bit of a buzz, and it brings us together. It's my roundabout way of saying that I'm grateful and I acknowledge. I'm well aware. I'm not so trying to be so smug. So, to listeners from Germany and Turkey, from Iran and Spain, from the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, United States, Australia, and Canada. Thank you so very much. It's a pleasure to have you. Welcome. Welcome. You have committed yourself for whatever reason to this process of scraping the surface and trying to understand Freemasonry. And I want to think that each of you, as you sit in today, has had the advantage of reliable and accessible mentoring. Where I am, very often it's been the opposite. Now, not to lament the fact and not to whining and complaining, it is an observation. But regardless, those of us who have been in experiencing this kind of condition have been very fortunate because of the conditions that brought you to Masonry and your success with mentoring and what you've learned. I have a dilemma thinking back to a time when discussions were lively about Masonry allowing our ritual to be put in print. I think what we can, in hindsight, look back at that moment and be grateful that we have something in writing that tells us about what was going on. Whatever the shreds are, we have people working with it to extract as much information as we possibly can, because we want and desire to learn. We want to learn the roots of masonry and use that information to help us sort out how it applies to us today. All of that, I think, is an effort at some kind of correction, as if the natural state is confusion, and I think that's plausible in a way. But if I had never been exposed to mathematics or chemistry or calculus or had never known a beauty and never seen an artist's work and a rendering, it wouldn't suggest that they didn't exist. But we did. We committed. We put it in writing. Maybe it was the excitement about the printing press. Maybe the sharing of knowledge at the same time. Can you imagine? Prior to that, if the scribes wrote a manuscript, I would read it and then I would hand it to one other and one other, or I would store it in my library. We weren't nearly, I don't think, as magnanimous, at least comparatively, as what was going on in the Arab nations. Some of their leaders were advanced, and I'm not just talking about the Genghis Khan kind of advancement. You know, you're ruthless, but you have this beauty to it, this sense of synergy. I conquer you, put down your swords, or we'll just kill everything that moves. But once we get over that, go about your religious practice and your way of life, and teach us everything about your way of thinking. Not to intrude, Genghis didn't feel that you're a threat, but it was curiosity. Different groups of men who studied had a different relationship to the creator. His was, what would you say, more animism but there was a spirituality to it as well. And we would say, oh my goodness, Christianity came along, certainly wanted the entire market share. So they said, well, there's a new word to describe all that business. And the new word is paganism. we don't want that. And that's very bad. And it wasn't that it existed in the state of minds. It needed to be put into existence, and it needed a term, because the major powers needed to push back on something and define the in-group, out-group. Hmm? The in-group, we're better at something, and the out-group, they don't have what we want, but they probably will come and take it. Holy mackerel, it's like we must have put a pin in time, because those kind of discussions, whether it was, you know, how to share information or our reflection about the state of religious belief and the freedom, has not even had a pause button being checked. The right people seem to be, we have turmoil going on. We know more because we are sharing information. And when we study it, we might study the same material and we might hate each other and draw different conclusions that prove our hatred is righteous and yours is wrong. But the fact remains that we also know that the way we handle our belief has some really interesting consequences. We can't kill the enemy. I'm part of a cultural group, all that nice Pictish and Scots kind of DNA and Norman DNA thrown in there. And the brought out our swords and we went at each other for how many hundreds of years. In the creation, it wasn't even, you know, Christian against Jew, against pagans. It wasn't even that. It was Catholics against Protestants, you know, just have a go at it. Just try and kill each other because one of us has to be right at the end of the day, until we just ostensibly got to the point where we were at a standstill. We killed and killed and killed and killed. And nobody was moving, nobody was budging. So the swords were put away, but not much the attitude. It was just, we were left with this notion that we're going to have to sort this out some other way. Because this other way, you know, just hacking at each other is far too expensive and completely unproductive. It didn't stop us launching crusades and unsuspecting people, you know. And, you know, you mix in a taste of whatever strange is the enemy. So those Islamists in Jerusalem, they had to be slaughtered. You know, they were taking over. And, well, now we know what was driving it. Money, you know, kings and popes that had spent their lot and were broke. A way of galvanizing the congregations. Yeah, we'll set a march. We'll organize ourselves. We'll become grand. Except the you fool us. What, you know, the people that these unsuspecting people were going about their business. The armies walked in and did a slaughter, but not a second time. Things changed. People got, yeah, okay, we're ready for you. All under the banner of the faithful. And if you think about it, is there still residue of that kind of stuff going on today? Well, yeah. Is there still somebody struggling to be right about it? Well, absolutely. Like you and I think we're struggling to be right, but we're reserving judgment because we don't have enough information. In the meantime, it's interesting, and we can respect what's there. Just because we don't understand it doesn't mean we have to try and kill it. Meanwhile, we find that coexistence is pretty good because we can sit down with a rabbi or a priest or an imam and talk. Tell me, you know, the same thing that we saw Genghis in history. You know, just come and teach us and tell us. Not that I'm sitting here ready on the perched on the edge of my chair to judge you. Oh my goodness! See, there's where you're wrong. I'm not talking about that. Not the lunacy of politics about it. The alarmists. No. You and I have had a hint, just a hint, just a tincture of common sense. Get over the rashness, yeah. So we can have that conversation. And well, the genius put down, the writer of Ritual put it in there, stuck it in. Well, that needs to be in there. And we need probability stuck in. So do something with the wheel, would you? Yeah, okay. So it's all built in there. If we're inclined to notice. But it doesn't stop people exercising agency, doing what people do. So for those of us who I often think of Masonic Lodge as a group of meerkats. You know, you see you're leaning into some serious conversation, but if there's the slightest scratch at the door, all these little heads are immediately distracted. Like there's nothing that brings them to focus all of their attention. Little heads pop up and swivel around. We completely lose track of the intensity. Okay, I'll be generous and I'll say even doing that, you can remain focused. You're just distracted, you know? Okay, different study habits. And then there's the folks that you could set off something nuclear at the door. They're not going to be turning around. To hell with you. Get into the room, sit down and be quiet. And don't be make such a fuss, and get on with the task. And then we have you who come to the door very keen to listen in on what the conversation, the direction the conversation is going before you even walked in. Fabulous. So we need this information, but it doesn't necessarily press us to use it. But then again, you don't really get to be part of those discussions until you show an awareness and you use those tools. Are there hints of the ability to use those tools before a person comes near a Masonic lodge? That's the question that these investigating committees have been ignoring where I am, ignoring for so very, very long. So I don't fault, say, bad men. You want to put your own spin on Masonry rather than studying what they're, be innovative, be creative. But these other discussions, they just happen. And it's an interesting, I think you'll agree, it's an interesting phenomenon. The more you read, the more you understand different areas in your own way, the greater the engagement, the greater the depths that we can achieve collaboratively, the discussion, the dialogue, and if you will, the narrative, it continues on. Not that we're parroting the words that were or the conversations of 14th century, 15th century, prototypes to our current lodges. No, but that we're accumulators. Every shred, every innovation in communication appeals to everyone. Everyone. It's one of our beautiful addictions or proclivities, let me put it that way. And we are not shy. So whatever is the latest. Now imagine that you and I are sitting around the lodge talking about this ritual that has up until then been happening mouth to ear. And we noticed like that game that we were taught when we were children with that whisper game in a big circle where a statement would be started and it had to be repeated word for word, mouth to ear around the circle. And the last person to receive it would tell the statement and to great gales of laughter because it had been so, so distorted. We were being taught what Masons have known for a long time. Way over there, their mouth to ear about the story is different than the boys over there. How the hell can we do that? There has to be a right and wrong to all of this, doesn't there? Well, if you came into Scottish Lodge, they might have said, well, really, that's none of your business because we've already been doing this for a long time before you arrived. So thank you very much for your interest. And by the way, if you want to sit politely, you can join us and learn. And people did. They shared and they learned. And then there were people like de Segolier going around trying to spread the gospel. He said, here, we've got something that's pretty good and we'd like to share. Well, no, we have our own ritual. Thank you very much. And that was happening all over England and Scotland. And well, they didn't care too much about Ireland because, who wants the Irish around then? Eh? You're an Englishman. You don't need those Irish buggers coming into your country. They don't bring anything and they don't add anything. Thank God that they were there. Or Masonry where I am wouldn't exist in the form it's in. Thank you. But the point is those discussions were still happening and unresolved, and people were pushing back, saying, oh, are you crazy? You can't put this in writing. It has to be secret, and the only way to govern that, well, now we have guys bragging about enlisting their wives to help them with ritual, and then it seems to blur a line where it doesn't even register. The fact that you took an obligation to maintain some degree, to maintain discretion and secrecy from the profane, doesn't matter. You've made that. The problem isn't what the fellow has done. The problem is that he's told it. He's told it to somebody that he ought not to. He made that decision. And that's why the not a problem, because guys were already telling. They were already telling. And they were having those loose conversations where they were admitting it. So there was an awareness that the integrity of mouth to ear wasn't what it was built up to be. Today we look around and we have that same kind of conversation, same concern. The same dynamics are occurring. What do we do? That isn't surrender, but is a way of preserving. What is it that we need to preserve? Masonry, the concern is that you and I, apart from the background noise, don't become distracted by it. That around us, we don't declare, and openly, we don't declare or mention the secrets. And people can press us and insult and threaten us. But when we are around, we're not going to be declaring, having those conversations with you. No. Because you may be quite right. You know, there's no secrets in the world anymore, because we've all been slavishly adhering to the newest form, the newest innovations in communication. And it's come to some consequence. And as we know from hundreds of years of written history, you know, the archives are there, that we correct on big scale over long periods of time. We're always looking for ways to improve. And yet, when a small group of men agree to maintain their confidence, then that's all that's necessary. Trust. One of those truths. You put down your weapons, I'll put down my weapons. You practice the way you choose, I'll practice the way I choose. Politics will carry on over top of us. We can't do anything about the hotheads and the firebrands. They can't do anything about that, but it doesn't mean we have to war over it. Yeah, that's the one. That's some of the interesting thing. You got a way of life over there. We've got a bunch of people that are ready to draw the swords to come after they've conjured up some indiscretion that's affected our pride, and you know it's all about male pride, isn't it? So I'm saying things have changed considerably, but the forces, the same forces, gravity existed back in the day before it was recognized. It existed. It's like calculus existed, except we didn't know, we didn't share that information. So does geometry, the sacred geometry, exist even though it's not shared? Yeah. It's there. So that's my opinion, but it seems that there's some meat on that bone, that all these things remain there. The truths that are taught and revealed in this really, really keen ritual. The metaphysics are there, waiting. It's like science waits for discovery. Art, on the other hand, that's a different horse of a different color. Right? We have a good show today. The search for legitimacy, who could walk away from that kind of commentary? I mean, really, this is pretty good stuff. And the music, again, like masonry, nobody in their right mind would put a bet that masonry would be around 300 years with this big bureaucracy and the weight of constitutional protections. Who would have, in their right mind, would have said, oh, gee, I'll bet you it'll be thriving in 2022. It's been the legitimacy that's not controlled. It's had that spark of inspiration, and watch what happens. And for all that time, guys have been sorting out the meaning and what you can do with it. It's not just what it means, but what can you do with it? Well, so all those forces are visited us again. And I'm going to let you decide how we're doing here. I'm going to put on some music to help us focus, relax, you go and replenish your beverage and get more comfortable. This is from a guy fairly new to me, Phineas Newborn Jr. See what you think. It's tuned. It's a tune that's been around. It's standard. I'm old fashioned. But see what you think. Thank you. Don't you just love the 60s? Couldn't go near a piece of music without adding strings, could they? Just couldn't. You have to have strings. That'll just bring it out. We were all smoking filtered cigarettes, as exotic as they were, and we could get together at the club for drinks and cigars. You know, very, very decadent. Got to have those strings, though. Brings a panache to everything. 60s. What would bring me to an awareness to even begin to write about legitimacy? This wasn't a one-off. It's like trying to round us out and think of what pulls us together while we have an individual study. That's not to say our thoughts are only legitimate if they're completely unique, because the test is the likes of me, where I doubt I would understand if I ever had an original thought. No, I'm not talking about the childishness that everything's plagiarism. That's ridiculous. But the way we form ideas, you know, there's a spontaneity to it, because our brains are so active all the time, and the idiosyncrasies of life are so active all the time, and we can reflect. We can still reflect on what's gone on previously. And in fact, those of you who've done a little research know that when you're sitting down, research is not always original design. But because, you know, in the materialist world, we're saying anything new, we have to make a buck or it's not worth it. We're going to close down entire university departments because the students are only enrolling in things that can make them a buck. Well, that's an intellectual minefield. The legitimacy that we're talking about here is what pulls all those individual thoughts together. Replication of research is one way of validating it, is a way that's been used to validate. And in fact, the research has to be, you have to demonstrate it, but it also has to be more than a one-off. So, you know, we've seen that in science around production of energy, where there's claims that it has been done, but the study couldn't be replicated. And we're talking about fine lines here. We're not talking about big, broad ideological sweeps. So replication brings us together. The consideration, if you and I are sitting down and we're talking about Nietzsche's work or Spinoza's work or what else would be common to Masonry, Dunn or Locke or, you know, pick one, we could still revisit. Only the context that we bring is different than it was before, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Here. That requirement between thinking men has always been prevalent. The legitimacy of your work is that it's provable, that you can articulate the work, and if anybody were to replicate the work, it makes it stronger. We do this in metaphorically when we're the way we handle a ritual, a meaning, and an understanding, it demonstrates the strength of it, because we can get the result of the research by replicating the study itself. So here you have this body of work, this pretty intense body of work, and can the outcome be achieved? Yeah, And why? And so for all the pundits that are saying, well, it isn't a uniform, well, you haven't done the work, have you? And your study habits and your lab practices are probably, you know, we know. It's not even conjecture. That's probably. We're not going to tell you where it is. Do your work yourself. That's you, you lazy sod. But don't be talking about whether it's the research is wrong. Come on, it's take a look at your own stuff. You're not a very good scientist, are you? If you want to swim in those waters, it takes the extra degree of precision. That's all I'm saying. No insult. Legitimacy, the idea. Oh, this really ties in nicely. It tied it in with some stuff that we were jumping into in a review of history about masonry and the stereotypic kind of advantage that we have examining what was going on in the Netherlands back in the day. Legitimacy, the idea that Dutch Freemasons took on powerful church and political interests because they sought legitimacy with the Grand Lodge of England is, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful declarations about purpose that I've read in many, many years. I want to own it, as should every legitimate brother so obligated. We can be as parochial as ever, but it doesn't push us off the primacy of our efforts to assert our practices to earn the legitimacy of our Mother Grand Lodge. Oh, complicated? Yeah. We are no more capable of setting standards of masonry as we are capable of producing our own version of geometry or mathematics. And when we use the tools wisely, creatively, we contribute to a body of knowledge accumulated from the finest minds that lived before us and around us. Listen to their music. Study their ways, their plays and poetry. Contemplating their artwork enables us to be influenced by that thinking. Apart from the necessity of governance and polity, our success is not determined in our house, but whether it has scratched the surface of legitimacy that no one owns but everyone celebrates. That's why we study the finest philosophers, for their clarity and logic. We know if we want to be accepted into that world of influence, we need to understand the work going on around us today is a continuance of thinking from the best minds. Because we have no need to be influenced by mediocrity. Capable of mastering that on our own. Merit is not what we decide. It is the audience to our performance that matters. So don't expect applause. But we can give ourselves a high five every now and then. Yeah. Legitimacy. You don't own it. Thank you. just something about the work of Horace Silver, isn't it? That's his tune, Lonely Woman. Nice work. Nice work if you can get it, eh? Just beautiful music. The poetry today. Assuming that attention to detail and doesn't have to be ruthless. This isn't an encounter. This isn't a damn intervention. Gentlemen have been doing it this way with a bit of subtlety. I like to think that the people tuning into Masonic Effects are exactly that. You have a capability of subtlety and discretion in your thinking. How have we learned? We didn't sit down with psychiatry. Maybe if you're in Midtown Manhattan, you can arrange your 7 years of intense psychotherapy. But for most of us, it comes in snippets, awareness. And maybe that's when you look at the audience of Tuxedo sitting there listening to Tosca, standing and raving about the last production of Tosca, or they leap to their feet because there's connections. Now we're hearing, Hamlet's being redone. Well, excellent. How to say, oh, well, gee, I've been there once. Why would I ever go and visit it again? It's like, my Lord, do you only look at a map once to decide where you're going? Do you only look at a painting once to describe? Do you ever see the glance and say, only once, I'm never going to look at any joy again because I've already had that experience. I've seen too much sorrow. I'm not going to look at it. I'm not going to acknowledge it anymore because I've already been there and done that. This is one of the advantages, the bravery of poets. We who have been had the advantage of having a brain and been exposed to education, being able to think. And having the time and the opportunity, which not all everybody has, first I'll admit that. But the refinement of the mind doesn't stop. I've had that taught to me repeatedly. The refinement of thought is something that is beyond economics and the politics. It's something that's remarkable and beautiful. The sciences and arts are fit into that portfolio so wonderfully. Poetry, the attention to detail. This is it's not without its critics. You're a fan of Bertrand Russell. He didn't really think much of Wordsworth's work. This is William Wordsworth we're talking about here. The guy born in 1770, so the writers of Masonry were reading what he was taught before he became a writer. And he had a little bit of an inheritance that allowed him the independence to write full time. So opportunity, yeah, this is interesting. As he said, every great and original writer, in proportion as he is great and original, must himself create the taste by which he is to be relished. He's an interesting guy. Born and educated at Cambridge. I guess it was the only school, so you go to Cambridge. Right? He had got an appointment as a distributor of stamps for Westmoreland, and that gave him financial stability. But it already been he took off and wandered around, fell in love with He was a poet laureate in 1843 at the age of 73. He replaced Robert Southey, who we've had on his work on the program. But he fell in love with traveling much earlier. He was traveling through France, doing his victory lap after graduation. And didn't he have a daughter? He had a fling with a French girl and produced a little girl. And being the upright kind of guy that he is, he spent the rest of his life trying to deny, keep it in secret and deny it. But the spineless guy got caught, was found. Isn't that always the way, eh? Isn't that always the way? That line about us, you know, there's a record being kept. Yeah, it's being kept. Don't think you're getting away. If you're thinking you're getting away with things, the only thing you're getting away with is deluding yourself. So we're getting into the world is too much with us. This apart, it challenges us. Do we look at the beauty of what the man created, or do we take that, you know, the personality and, you know, any proclivities? Well, I don't know how many of us would do well if the world was judging everything that we did. My goodness, have I ever done anything embarrassing or humiliating? Yeah. Do I want to talk about it? No. That's the norm, isn't it? Let's move on. Learn from. How do we learn from mistakes if we don't make mistakes? Huh? To walk around proudly declaring them? Shit, are you stupid? This channels that kind of anger. The world is too much with us. So this is a speaker, and he accuses the modern age of having lost its connection to nature and everything meaningful. Well, a bit ironic, don't you think? Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Yep, everything's about, let's cut down the old growth forest to make a subdivision. Yep, got to have that. We don't have enough parking lots, absolutely. And the bear trails are in there. Well, you know, eventually we're going to have to kill all the polar bears because their habitat is ruined, and they're going to come where we are to feed their young. So, of course, we're just going to have to kill them or put them all in cages. Yep, you know, we can't. Oh, as far as stopping the rape of the land, no, we can't do that. That's there to be exploited. Every oligarch will tell you, you know. And that oil leak off the coast, cost of doing business, except whoop, the toilet bowl is running over. The oceans can't handle it anymore. The joke's on us, eh? The world is too much with us falls in line with a number of sonnets written by Wordsworth in the early 1800s that criticize what Wordsworth saw as the decadent material cynicism of the time. I wonder what he would think looking out his window at what's going on today. Cynicism has metastasized. It's polarized. Yeah, everybody's opinion, it's not the way. People have access to communication, and they're taking advantage of it. And it's creating odd alliances. Not always this is judgy, isn't it? Not always in the best interest. Anything goes. The Confederate flag, just it's my declaration. It's just a flag. It's history. Well, it's also a dog whistle for racism. So the decadence, the rich are getting richer, the rest are paying for it. So sit down, pull up your tool. We're going to just listen to this. We're going to tuck into this poem. This is he was 32 years old when he wrote this in 1802, and it was published 5 years later, so he was making a buck on it. And it is a heartfelt response to, you know, cottage industry was falling apart, the rural way of life was changing. Yeah, I don't think they had, and this is the precursor of agribusiness that we have today, which may have taken over you know, rural life, mass production and factory, industrial livestock. People were no longer in touch with nature. So you don't want to be exposed to weather. You don't want to be exposed to smells of the country. And the challenge is you take your money and you don't have to care about the environment because you're decadent. So he wrote a letter about the decadent material cynicism of the time. And this is a little sonnet that he wrote and it reflects his almost helplessness to correct the imbalance between the spiritual and material. England at the time was, invention was going crazy and entrepreneurship was just growing. Steam engines were built for the, being built for the mines and mills and new railways, and factories were springing up to deal with the textiles and large scale industrialization. It was taking shape. But population increases meant that ordinary folk could no longer sustain living off the land. The countryside had been unaltered for centuries and was becoming mechanized and enclosed. Whole families would end up working in the mills and mines. This was a rapid and irreversible change, perhaps equivalent to the digital and globalization revolution of the modern times. What do you think? But he puts this, he encapsulates this quantum leap into a cash economy from the cottage industry. And the race for profit had begun on a scale never before seen. But at what cost to the human spirit? Oh, this is no fantasy. We're just going to stop, unplug this and start with a, going back. So if you're thinking that he's writing maybe wistfully, maybe ironically about the days gone by when we had those things, well, of course, it's a sonnet, so it's short. See if he captures it. Does he touch it? And does he touch it in a way that resonates within you? The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending. We lay waste our powers. Oh, I want to quote that one again. Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bares her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours and are upgathering now like sleeping flowers, for this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn, so might I, standing on this pleasant lee, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn. Have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Is it common to have those moments? When the world around you stands still and you're in the bookstore and you reach for something, and what catches your eye triggers a remembrance, a memory of that fond and lost relationship. And there you sit, enjoying, experiencing the bittersweetness. Eh? Thank you. Don't be fooled thinking that Ben Webster wasn't aware of the effect his music had on the audience. He knew it was a love affair, wasn't it? He loved the music and he shared it. Yeah, that's courage. What if history told us things about ourselves today, revealed things only from the safety of a great, great distance? We're not caught up with the silliness of being triggered in any way. We're just absorbing it. We've been working through what's gone on in the Netherlands, and the connection with the United Grand Lodge back in the day. And here, I want to step this up, 1770. Masonry's already hit its heyday. It's already getting feedback from lodge members. Hey, this is boring. Who wants to study every time? Who needs something that's going to liven it up? We've already had lodges creating those delightful lists of thou shalt nots. If you're intemperate, or there's drunkenness or cursing in a lodge, there's a penalty. Pay up or we'll turf you out. Hero, my goodness, we don't have the courage to do anything near like that, even, let alone think about it. So we have to tolerate somebody standing up and pontificating or bringing an ill wind into a lodge. Well, we just have to suck that up, which just encourages the little narcissists. Eh? That's awareness. Here, this part of history captures the historian of the Netherlands, late 18th century Dutch Freemasons. Their historian was Alexander de Vinol, and he wasn't ordinary. He had been a deputy grand master in England, and he was a signatory on a new copy of the Constitution sent in 1770. By the British Grand Lodge to its Dutch brethren, and an extremely active brethren in the Netherlands. That tells us that when there's a change in the Mother Lodge, the Constitution, it's distributed. And it will be here. Only what's done with that? move on here, catch up. He wrote interesting manuscript histories of masonry, and he traveled extensively in Germany and Italy, and he wrote about it in Italy, in Naples, in Berlin and Sweden. He sat down and he was writing. And the Neapolitan text is complete with lists of brothers and their occupations, which makes for good reading if you're inclined, if you have a question. And his manuscript, and I underlined this, his manuscript history of Dutch Freemasonry, written in 1778, begins with a statement that directly relates its spirit, its search for wisdom, to be the spirit that lies at the foundation of the main legislative body of the Dutch Republic and the States General. Do you hear what he's saying? The spirit of Dutch Freemasonry. He's aligning that with the main legislative body, the profane world. As he goes on, the royal art of masonry should rightly be an analog to the spirit of sweetness and wisdom, which stands at the base of the government of the Estates General of the United Provinces. He's speaking about Netherlands. For victorious after overcoming the first obstacles, Freemasonry has rapidly prospered. Freemasons self-consciously came to see their organization as analogous to the civil polity, as practicing the same virtues that rest as the foundation of its main legislative body, the Estates General. So we're talking about what? Equality? A sense of fairness? That was what de Vignol said in his history. We might imagine that his meaning was metaphorical, that his hyperbole got the better of him, but we have evidence that de Vignol meant exactly what he said. Be afraid, eh? Be afraid. When Dutch Freemasons organized their national system of authority and governance, the Grand Lodge of the Netherlands, established in The Hague in 1756, they adopted the form of the Estates General of the Republic. This body forms the sovereign tribunal of the nation, and it permits a degree of sovereignty and independence to the provinces that send representatives to it. These are the words of de Vignol, writing in his capacity as provincial Grand Master in London, and attempting to deal with a rebellious lodge in Berlin in 1774. To encourage the members' obedience and their conformity with the Grand Lodge of Prussia, and hence with the London Grand Lodge, de Vignol cited the older Dutch system of administration of the society, Masonic governance, as a model. Oh, because Dutch Freemasons were jealous of their liberty, all the states assembled in 1756 and adopted this structure in the Masonic system of government as described by de Vignol. Each lodge is a state within the Masonic nation. Whew, does it fit? Does it fit? Who determines that? It would seem that this wasn't determined centrally. This is Magna Carta, eh? This is Magna Carta. Don't be telling us this is locking the monarch out of parliament. Don't be telling us you're in charge of anything. We'll tell you what the limits of your authority are. Very fine, and we'll all honor the king. But don't be telling us you're running government. Yeah. And by the way, we sent Cromwell out to behead that bugger that got too carried away in his divinity. So does this resonate? I would like to think it does. Here, ponder this over Charlie Parker. Wasn't a great human being to be around, but his music. I see from the clock on the wall that our time together is coming to an end for this week. The change that you need to see matches the stability that you require to continue the legacy of Freemasonry. Oh, it's not industrialized knowledge and wisdom. No, not nearly. We have the advantage, as I said earlier, of all those beautiful, beautiful atmospheres created to inspire, that inspire to this day. By their very presence, they're a voice, they're a mention, a reflection of history. It's like that feeling you get when you're sitting in the coldness of Roslyn Chapel all by yourself. You're hearing sounds somewhere, but they're just echoing through in this unformed. Then things begin to catch your eye. Maybe it was a place for apprenticing Masons to demonstrate their skills. That would make sense. Bring them all there and have them see what was done before them and have that. If you're going to influence from the top, right? Yeah. Or maybe you have wandered past the apprentice pillar and just been amazed. It's like filigree. It's lace, isn't it? How do you do that? Today we have that with us. We've seen efforts to industrialize masonry, but it's not. When masonry becomes impersonal, it doesn't really work. That's why you and your mates are the heartbeat of Freemasonry. When we get into the dynamic of large halls, that's performance. That's performance, and it's necessary to reinforce certain themes and messages, pomp and circumstance, yeah. But the work is not so much top-down as from the inside out. Those influences. So find your source, your muse in a way, your inspiration, and make it your own. And then pass that legacy, what you absorb. How do I say this? It's not what you know. It's the respect that you have for what you don't know. The capacity to listen instead of being preachy. Instead of hearing your own voice, hear the voice of the entered apprentice. And have the patience. You know, it hangs up there. You've crowed about it, that tassel, that temperance. Yeah. Oh, it's not putting down the bottle and put the cap back on the bottle. It's not that kind of temperance. You'll find, you'll eventually get there. And I hope you do. Next week, we'll pick the show up. And I already have some interesting, more and more interesting commentary going on. The music. Is there ever a time when music doesn't resonate? Yeah. Thanks for tuning in, and I appreciate your support. I'll see you all again very, very soon. And if our paths cross, all the better. Be sure to let me know that you've been listening to us. So it wouldn't kill anybody to share. If they have somebody they know that would like this, just share the link. See you soon.
Thank you.